I realized I'm a little bit salty towards the sentiment of keep doing it, it'll pay off one day, because that places the benefits of doing something above doing something, like the benefits of creation
Oh
above
yeah.
creation itself.
Yeah.
Like it, and it doesn't even really work that way for other things. It's not like, oh, start sn like we've been snowboarding a bunch this week. It's like start snowboarding because it'll pay off
It'll, yeah,
someday.
interesting,
It
yeah.
won't, but
Yeah.
it's so fun, and so you
Seriously.
do it anyway.
Disturbing the peace for some peace of mind. Sleeping in jeans, I'ma need a knife. OD on the cheap advice. OC on the cheapest flight. Lately, I've been on the move trying to get to something. But I told her I've been running just to see the sights.
Welcome back to Friends with Benedicts for a extremely special episode.
Highly unique. I'd like to initially apologize for all the background noises you're going to hear because my apartment has been silent for weeks on end and now there's a bunch of construction upstairs.
Dude, I could have sworn the upstairs of your apartment was just actually abandoned because I've literally never heard any movement or any single noise above your place
I know, and now
ever.
there's legitimately screaming and sawing and drilling happening.
Yeah, we were setting up to like children stomping around and playing and but hey,
Hey.
look at us.
We've been snowboarding like so much since Jake has been here, and we're both like so beat, but we're gonna kick into gear.
Yeah.
We're gonna kick into gear.
I was like, dude, I think I'm gonna come to Gunnison and hang for a while and we should record some podcasts and we should film some videos and like really focus on some video stuff. And I got here in day one, we're just like, let's go snowboarding, let's go snow skating, let's go skateboarding. The first day we literally did all three of those things. We snowboarded for a good 5 or 6 hours, and then we skateboarded, and then we snow skated until it was too dark.
Yeah, we've been going pretty hard. And then we went snowboarding all day the next day. So, but hey, whoa, whoa. But that's fine because now we're.
Basically, what we're saying is, dude, it's so hard to podcast when you've just been having so much fun lately.
I know.
We got some riveting news stories today. We got some hard-hitting film discussions to have. So, buckle up.
And here we go.
Don't you have a big news story or something?
Oh, am I opening with that? Okay.
Oh, I guess so. I
Yeah,
don't know.
I'll open with that. Okay, Jake. What is the best bird?
Probably crow.
Wrong.
Dang.
Parrot. Well, it is parrot. Discussion over.
Dang, why didn't no one
Because
teach me that?
parrots can talk. And in London, this British wildlife park is having a problem because all their parrots are cussing. And
No
so,
way.
yes.
Wait, wild parrots in London?
No, it's a wildlife park
Oh,
in Britain, a
wildlife
British wildlife
park.
park.
Okay.
And they're trying to rehabilitate these parrots.
Do the parents have Brit or the parrots have British
That's a
accents?
good question. I don't know. This is just a like this is an article. There's no examples,
Please tell
but
me the parents are saying like bloody wank stain and stuff like
Dude, well,
that.
it's okay. Yeah, it's pretty great because so back in 2020, five foul-mouthed African grey parrots donated to the Lincolnshire Wildlife Park in eastern England were isolated from the flock in an attempt to improve their language. But from Tuesday, the team is adopting a different, riskier approach of integrating three newly donated cuss-happy birds named Eric, Captain, and Sheila alongside the five miscreants into the flock. Okay, so if you're in charge of rehabilitating cussing pirate or pirates parrots or
Yeah.
pirates, what how would you do it? Because they have such
You
an awesome tactic here, but I want to see if you can get there.
play endless loops of Sesame Street and Mr. Rogers in their cages.
That's not a terrible idea.
Oh, okay.
I'll give you a really quick hint. The outcome could it could solve their problem, or it could compound it and make it literally 10 times worse.
I don't know. I wish I knew more about parrots.
Okay, we'll keep going. Well, so to circle back on when you were like, please tell me they're saying like wanker and stuff. This is an amazing quote. It says, when we came to move them, the language that came out of their carrying boxes was phenomenal. Like, really bad. Not normal swear words. These were proper expletives, said the park's chief executive, Steve Nichols. So, yeah, they're, like, definitely going hard. All right. Are you ready to hear their tactic?
Yeah.
Okay. We've put 8 really, really offensive swearing parrots with 92 non-swearing ones. If the new strategy works, the 8 parrots could learn all the nice noises like microwaves and vehicles reversing that the other parrots in the flock favor, Nichols added. But if the other 92 instead pick up the expletives, it's going to turn into it's going to be an adult aviary. So
it has to be the latter. Like, because all of those parrots are going to think they're interesting new sounds that they haven't heard before.
Yeah, I mean, after some time in isolation, integrating the 5 original birds into the flock was mostly successful. So it turns out they had a little bit of the opposite problem. And Nichols says they still curse sometimes and even laugh afterwards.
That would be terrifying.
Yeah, and then Dude. Also this is also great because they're imitating people. So 6 of them have male voices, and 2 of them have ladies' voices when they're swearing.
There's no way this isn't intentional. This park is totally purposefully making their parrots cuss a ton because that has to bring in so much business. Do you know how many people would not care at all about a wildlife park, but as soon as they hear that there's cursing parrots in it, they're definitely going.
The article also says one of the other problems they were having is once people started realizing they were cussing parrots, they're having a problem where their customers would come and cuss lot more because they'd be like yelling cuss words at the parrots to get them to
repeat it. Yeah.
But I thought this was interesting. Expletives are particularly easy to mimic for African grays since they're almost always said with the same tone and context without any other words surrounding them, which I thought was interesting.
Yeah, and like one syllable.
Yeah, it's like a one syllable quick word that like – and yeah, it's so perfect because cuss words, it's like they barely need any context and they don't need any different vocal inflection, and yet they still mean like 100 million different things. They're such interesting words.
Yeah.
It's like the perfect word for a parrot to pick up.
Dude, I think it's just a genius move on the wildlife park side, and they're trying to act like they're concerned about it. It's a big problem, but business is booming over there.
Yeah,
right,
that's
now.
True. They're like, oh no, we put them in with 92 other parrots to get them to stop.
Yeah, yeah, totally.
But meanwhile, what they really were thinking was, we got a gold mine on our hands.
We got to reproduce these cussing parrots. Sell them to as many adjacent wildlife parks as possible.
Dude, and then it's hard to talk about this without like whatever mimicking what this would sound like, but so I'm not going to, but
yeah.
Can you imagine walking into a wildlife aviary with 92 parrots just screaming fuck at you?
It'd be amazing if they're good enough to like actually roast you.
I know, that would be awesome. That'd be so cool. Well, they said they're like as smart as like orangutans and dolphins, these parrots.
Oh, really?
These African greys.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
So they probably could evolve to that point. But the best thing is, it's just like AI couldn't write that, you know? It's like 92 parrots screaming expletives at you. It's just, it's too good to be, and it's real. I just like that it's real.
That's really cool. Have we talked about crows on this podcast before?
Oh, crow, back to crows. No,
we talked
about
the
actual
best bird on this podcast. Well, they're pretty cool.
Prove it.
Well,
good luck,
dude.
I just laid the hammer down on parrots being the best.
Okay.
But
okay. You're right. Foul mouth parrots is pretty cool. But crows are pretty cool because I think it's pretty well known that they're like strong facial recognition.
Yeah.
And so there's this study done.
Parrots are like face ID. Or crows are like face ID.
Yeah.
Parrots are voice ID.
Wait.
Never mind.
Crows or face ID.
Right.
Yeah. Crows or face ID. Exactly.
Right.
But yeah, there's this study done where this guy would go into a park where there's a bunch of crows. And I think he would, man, I should have looked this up before I started talking about it. I read it a long time ago, but I think he would either like throw rocks at the crows or hit people or something, do something crazy, you know, something violent. He's doing something violent and kind of did it a couple times. And after that, anytime he would walk through the park, just peacefully walk through it, the crows would go crazy, like bunch of noise, like fly right past his face.
Whoa.
All this stuff get like super, super wild. And then after that, he would walk through with a mask on, like a rubber, you know, different face mask on. And it was just like silent. The crows wouldn't do anything. And supposedly, if you have crows at in your house or something in your area, you can like befriend them and they'll defend you. Like, because in that study, I think they had someone work to kind of befriend the crows, like give them food or whatever, just always be like a friend of the crow. And then they had a guy like push her or something, like do something bad to her, and the crows would defend her and fly down and like attack the dude that was attacking her. So yeah. So, case in point, you can befriend crows at your house and you'll have a freaking army of defense at your home with crows. So,
carry on.
If I had to choose my home defense, well, okay, honestly, it could
go
either way.
It's always got to be a competition with you, doesn't it? Crows versus ferrets. I do want to isolate one sentence out of what you just said, which was a friend of the crows. And I think forever now in my mind you're going to be Jake Fruit, friend of the crows.
I could not think of a better honor in my life than to be known as Jake Fruit, friend of the crows. Someday, man. Someday I'll be friends with them. But it would be interesting to see how effective which of the two camps would be better for home defense. Because if you had an army of parrots that just insulted anyone that came
true.
That'd be a pretty good deterrent.
Yeah, and also, I'm just thinking about my day-to-day life and where I live and everything, and I think if I walked by a house and it had like 800,000 crows on it, I would say, huh, that's a lot of crows. If I walked by a house and it had not even that many, like 92 cussing parrots on it, man, I was going to say I'd keep my distance, but I think that would probably become the talk of the town.
Yeah, you would probably just end up standing in front of that house a bunch.
Yeah, I don't think I'd rob it, though.
But you
You're
would
trying
rob
to
the
break
house
into the house
thousands
and there's
of
all
crows.
These voices like...
Yeah, I think you would say, huh, that's a lot of crows. Until you opened the gate and took one step into the yard
and they all
start swarming your head and squawking
at
you.
Yeah, or you open the gate and all the parrots start cussing at you.
Yeah.
Either way, good home defense system.
Yeah. So,
Jake Fru, friend of the crows.
Well, with that valuable insight. Mm-hmm. Oh, there's really brief, super brief space news since everyone's here for that.
Yeah.
Japan landed on the moon. But they did it upside down.
Didn't one of the engines break or something?
Yeah, something happened like just as it was in the like landing deceleration phase, an engine failed and so it flipped over. But there's still hope that it could be okay, because the problem is it landed with its solar panel down.
Mm-hmm.
So the batteries are dead, but they're hopeful that like with enough days it'll get some charge, because it does have a mechanism that can flip itself back over.
Oh.
But there's not enough battery charge for that. But hopefully it does, because it's in like a cool zone of the moon that they're like
cool zone of the moon,
you know, pretty cool zone.
Yeah,
it's a really up and coming neighborhood of the moon.
So Jake, what makes this zone of the moon cool?
Well, there's some cool rocks there.
Okay.
There's a thought of potential frozen water
there. Oh, that is cool.
But yeah.
Didn't I also see the landing was like pinpoint accuracy too? It was like exactly where they wanted to be, but just upside down.
I didn't see anything about that, but if it was Japan, that has to be true.
That's true.
Yeah, that's got to be true.
Well, shout out to Japan. Thanks for all the hard work that you've put in for space. Yeah. We salute you.
Thanks for landing on the moon instead of just flying around the dark side.
Whoa, maybe season two of Friends with Benedict will be Friends with Benedict's Breakfast Around the Moon.
Ooh.
And we'll just transition hard into space news only.
That's a good idea.
Thanks.
Well, I guess before we do that, we could stick to our more common topic of movies and film and YouTube. You want to kick us off on the Sundance theme?
Yes. So, actually say three things about Sundance. Top three things about Sundance while I pull up where
Sundance
I got the story from.
Film Festival. Well, there's a lot of talk about Sundance right now. I think it just finished last week or something.
I didn't even know it was happening.
Yeah.
Which honestly is good for what we're talking about here.
Yeah, totally. It's weird because Sundance has always been in my head as this really cool thing. I'm sure everyone knows, but Sundance is a film festival. It's a very, very prestigious, I guess.
Probably the most prestigious in the United States.
Yeah. Yeah. So a bunch of big media buyers are there looking to buy films.
Traditionally there have been. That's part of the problem.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So thank you for saying those three things, Jake, while I pulled this up. But this sort of mostly came to my attention because of a YouTube channel, Dean Peter 2ON. I think it's supposed to be Peterson and the two's the S. But, you know, it's the internet. And he made a video called Sundance is Broken. And his video is based off of a article by Megan Gilbride and Rebecca Green. So this is all coming from these sources. But anyway.
So we're a podcast talking about a YouTube video that was talking about a blog.
Well, I just don't want it to seem like we came up with this. Yeah, like I want to say where I got this from.
We're just making sure it hits all formats.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, but thesis being Sundance Film Festival is, I don't even know really the right next words to say. You could fill in the blank with losing credibility. You could fill in the blank with is too exclusive. You could fill in the blank with is losing relevance. You could fill in the blank with is not worth it for filmmakers.
Does anyone care about Sundance?
Jake and I both, whether or not we're going to use the filmmaker word, we're very much in this
we're
circle.
We're using it now.
We're filmmakers and we're in the circle, and I don't think either of us were, I mean, maybe you were tuned into the fact that it was happening, but I don't think you were excited to find out what got played and stuff. Like,
no.
Can you name one thing that played this year or in the last?
No.
Like, the article says, ask anyone to name a film that played at Sundance in the last 10 years, and almost no one can, regardless of how invested in the industry they are.
Yeah, and not only that, I am for sure in the circle that should be invested, and I just read an article 30 minutes ago about the top picks of Sundance. I don't remember or know anything about them.
Yes. So let's talk about why you would go to Sundance Film Festival as a just consumer of film media, and then why you would go to Sundance Film Festival as a filmmaker.
Yeah.
So we'll actually start with filmmakers. If you're a filmmaker, if you get accepted into Sundance Film Festival, traditionally, it's been a really big deal. They give you a stipend budget for expenses and travel. I think it's $750 for expenses and $500 for travel. You get to
total?
Go. Total? You get to go. You get to show, you know, you get to premiere or show your film or whatever. You get to go to all the parties and everything. And then hopefully, your film is noticed by a bunch of high up people in the industry. You might get a distribution deal. That's what it's sold as. What it actually is your film gets into Sundance. The expenses to get there and lodging and food will oftentimes for one person exceed $4,000, which is well beyond your, your stipend budget. Yeah. Now, because it's losing so much interest and so much notoriety, it's almost certain that your film won't get, it won't land with a distributor. I think it said, don't quote me on this for sure. I think the article or somewhere else I said, I saw said that last year, only one film from Sundance got a distribution deal.
Whoa.
Which is crazy.
Yeah.
Because traditionally that's kind of been the thing. It's like, oh, my career takes off. This YouTube video, Dean was saying he knows people personally who have gotten films into Sundance, and it made little to no impact on their career. And not only that, but they're like in the hole of debt because the travel and the expenses and the lodging and everything are so expensive. So for a filmmaker, it's becoming less and less worth it. Now, the flip side of that is if you're a consumer, just a normal person wanting to go, all of those costs are the same. You get to see the film, sure, but there's barely any benefit for you either because it's so expensive.
Yeah.
Getting around Park City is a nightmare. Apparently, it seems like every year during the festival, they get some huge storm or whatever, and so people either can't get there or you can't get from theater to theater. So anyway, it's falling apart, basically, for everyone involved.
As an attendee, it would be so fun. It's been such a dream of mine for so long because... I don't know. I mean, for me personally, that's just such a fun thing to do, to get to go to any film festival. That's always been one of my favorite pastimes, I guess, going to any film premiere or video premiere. So like that part of it's really alluring. But yeah, the biggest hinder to that is always that it sells out. It's extremely expensive. It's just like, it's a ton of money to go as just, if you're going as an entertainment event, it just doesn't make sense. Even though it would be so fun, it doesn't make sense.
Yeah, and there's kind of an interesting Venn diagram you're trying to reach with the film festival, which is you want it to be good enough that people are wanting to go, but you want it to be accessible enough that people like can afford to go.
Mm-hmm.
And so anyway, all this to say, there's kind of just in the world of film festivals in general, a little bit of a crisis because – filmmakers are starting to – there's like kind of a little bit of a movement happening right now, which is like people, filmmakers in general, just are losing interest in film festivals as a whole because it's so expensive to submit your film. That's another crazy thing. To even submit your film for people to watch, to consider to go into these festivals, there's like these massive submission fees. So people are losing a ton of money to submit to these festivals. The chances of getting in are close to zero, even if you have an incredible film, because there's so much competition and there's so much insider dealing that happens to get films shown. And the prospect of getting it into the festival at best is you get it into a theater and it's shown in front of whatever, like, you know, if you're really super lucky, like 300, 500, even up to 1,000 people, that's amazing. Or you can post it online and have the chance of it hitting the algorithm. And, like, who knows? Like, there's a chance it goes to just as few people. But it's free. And there is this very real chance that if whatever, the retention's good, if it gets picked up and shared by whoever, it's like it could hit 1 million. It could hit 2 million. Mm-hmm. It could, you know, it's like there's this unlimited cap on it where it's like you could just put all this work into it, self-distribute it, and it could change your life in ways that these film festivals promise to do but are not fulfilling that promise on.
Yeah. Yeah, and that kind of hits on a big part of this discussion that I wanted to talk about, and that's like the value of curators.
Mm-hmm.
We have talked about Schaefer's Pick of the Week, for example. Great example of a curator where someone like you, I trust your taste so much that I want your curated recommendations.
Mm-hmm.
So anytime you give a recommendation to me, it's like, dude, I'm definitely going to watch that. And to me, that's one of the big, that would be the draw of attending Sundance is it's very curated. There's people whose job is being a programmer for Sundance is that they watch, I don't know, 10, 12 movies a day, 8 to 10 movies a day. They watch a bunch of movies every single day, nonstop, and basically select ones that are worthy of making it to Sundance or not. So that, like, that act is really cool, and a curated feed is really cool, but it's an interesting discussion of that versus the algorithmic curator.
Well, so that was kind of what I was going to bring up, was in the world of self-distribution, the curator becomes the algorithm.
Mm-hmm.
And so that feels like a compromise, because like you're saying, the algorithm is not going to look at a film the same way a person is.
Mm-hmm.
But it's almost, in certain ways, an equal compromise depending on who the curator is, because Sundance is now associated or in the same hot tub with the Hollywood world. Mm-hmm. And the Hollywood world runs so much more off of, you know, connections. Who do you know? How do they know this person? How can they guarantee to this investor? Blah, 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 blah. And so there's so many moving parts. So in an idealized world, you're right. The Sundance film, people are just sitting in there in their living rooms watching 8 to 10 movies, to 10 movies a day.
Maybe 12 if they're super ambitious and don't sleep at
all. Right. But the slots that they have are so much more limited now, because they're like, oh, we have this filmmaker who's premiering this, and so that slot's taken, and we have this. And so it's not democratic at all.
Oh,
and
yeah.
It's not,
and they
based
usually
off
have
quality.
Specific themes that they need to fill. Or,
So like, maybe the algorithm is not as good of a curator, but it's more democratic than a Sundance programmer.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's exactly my thought on it. It's like the idea of a curator is so good, but unfortunately, the curator traditionally has been so stifled by money being a major factor, by whatever, like you said, like the networking aspect, all of that is so clouded. And I very recently complained about the algorithm in a YouTube video of mine.
Yeah.
But at least on YouTube, I'm getting pretty impressed by the YouTube algorithm lately.
Mm-hmm.
Just, I mean, this is a side tangent, but I don't know about you, I'm getting so many recommendations for views that have less than 1,000 recommendations for videos that have less than 1,000 views on them.
Yeah,
that's
too. Yeah, small channels are starting to get recommended to me more and more, which is super exciting. And let's not forget too, the algorithm, as evil as it can be, and how it's the virus that breeds the Mr. Beasts of the world. Essentially, it is based off of audience engagement. For every single complaint you have about the algorithm, it stems in some way from a human consumer of the video.
Totally.
Which, you know, that has also bred the ridiculously stupid notion of how important a title and a thumbnail are.
Yeah.
Like, negative, for sure. Positive is, if human beings are engaging with the artwork, then the algorithm will reward it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when you gamify that and you turn that into whatever retention strategy and all that sort of stuff, it becomes more of a negative than a positive, because then essentially you're doing the same thing you would with a Sundance curator, which is like, oh, we want to see something like this, so make us something like this. It's the same sort of pressure. So there are positives and negatives to both, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as benefit for the filmmaker, in my opinion, the positive for self-distribution online is starting to outweigh the positives of even getting a film in Sundance.
Yeah.
Which is crazy, because it's free and available to everyone.
Totally. Yeah, I think it's inevitable that since there is so much more stuff on YouTube, like, of course that algorithmic curator is going to allow more, I don't even know what to call it. Just kind of like hacky way of getting attention.
Mm-hmm.
But I also think it definitely does allow for like truly great things to also get that attention. And yeah, I mean, you kind of already said it, but it's like a pet peeve of mine. Anytime people say the algorithm hates me or just basically chooses to call themselves a victim of the algorithm.
Mm-hmm.
And like, I just feel like it would do anyone so much benefit when they're saying that to say like, like, yeah, to replace the word algorithm with people.
Right.
And just be like, okay, what is it that people aren't interested in that I'm doing? And right. Like, what? Yeah, I don't know.
So a beautiful real world example of this. So over the last couple of weeks, and I promise we'll stop, but we've been talking a lot about my outdoor industry video. But a comment I got a lot on the outdoor industry video was people were like, oh, this would fit well at the Banff Film Festival, which is a big outdoor industry film festival, which I just laughed at because I'm like, dude, okay, the video, sorry, humble brag here, but the video is pushing 200,000 views now. You think the Banff Film Festival would get me 200,000 views on that video? Not a chance in hell, dude. And we have talked, of course, about the depth of a view versus the width of a view. Mm-hmm. It's like, it is, there are definitely like higher quality views at the film at the Banff Film Festival. But to me, it felt like two middle fingers to the stupid Banff Film Festival. Yeah. Because it's like,
it seems
my
like
film is starting discussion in the outdoor industry, at least in a small way. And that just never happens at the what played at the Banff Film Festival in the last 20 years, dude? Well, probably Free Solo.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And I mean, not only that, I know of the Banff Film Festival, but I know nothing of the content that has historically been added.
I think it's pretty outdoorsy, but yeah.
Well, yeah, definitely. But what I'm saying is I don't know what type of sponsorships are there. Mm-hmm. And to me, my first thought is, well, if they have all of these sponsorships kind of controlling the videos, something like yours that really attacks a lot of the major players in the outdoor industry might not get there just because they have certain sponsors to please or something. You know what I'm
right.
saying?
Like, which is a point in favor of the democratization thing I was talking about. Like, a cool thing about the AdSense way of, you know, monetization is it is completely separated from the content of whatever you're uploading, which can be a negative because you see these horrible channels uploading like insane stuff. Like, I'm not even going to give an example, and they still get money from it. So there's negatives to that too.
Right, right.
But yeah, I mean, if you're a filmmaker and you see that and you're like, if someone like lined me up against the wall and they said, you have to choose a premiere at the Banff Film Festival or 200,000 organic views on your channel, which would you, I would be like, I want the latter.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
And for these film festivals to be so expensive too, it's like, I choose that, I get more benefits from it, and I don't have to spend $4,000 to go to this thing, which also kind of a negative too, because we've been talking about this off air while you've been here, but there is a lot of power in like showing your work in person with people, which I think is a nice transition into what Sundance is sort of transitioning into from here to address some of these issues. Do you want to talk about that?
Well,
seriously, there's like full-on drilling happening upstairs.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say basically every single benefit I see to the film festivals now are basically all social and personal benefits.
Mm-hmm.
Like, yeah, if I'm thinking about nothing but my work as a filmmaker and my business as a filmmaker and my audience reach, yeah, it's YouTube all day long. But if I'm thinking about how it feels to show my film and how my personal well-being as a human on this planet feels, man, a film festival just sounds so much better. Getting to hang out with people,
for sure,
talk about stuff you love, show your video, have an audience there. It, like, there's so much good about it. But yeah, something needs to change because the current model just doesn't work at all.
Right.
And I think I read that article fairly quickly. It sounds like that article by the name you said earlier is essentially proposing ideas that could help Sundance. I think the Sundance contract ends in 2026 or something like that. And this person was proposing ideas.
Yeah, I don't know if that was super clear to me either. I don't know if Sundance is doing it. Or I think Sundance has been doing like a film tour thing.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I don't know. I'd have to maybe do some self-research on that one. But yeah, whether it be the proposed idea or something that they've been trying, is essentially a traveling film festival where they get whether they be local filmmakers or select filmmakers to premiere like on this tour, essentially, which is an interesting idea. And I think another interesting idea that addresses what you're talking about a little bit, and I cannot speak to the experience of what these things are like, but I know that there is a rising set of, be it like film festivals or events or whatever, that are like YouTube creator centric, like,
yeah,
I don't know what they're called, but I always see people are showings at like, I'm at like VidCon or whatever, like, and they're showing YouTube videos in theaters and everything like that. So that's like kind of a little bit an attempt to address what you're talking about. My personal opinion, dude, being in a room full of YouTube creators to self-congratulatory watch vlogs does not sound like a good time to me, but... And that's another thing, that's another negative with the YouTube format, is like YouTube has a little bit of a language, a visual language and style in and of itself that does not translate to a theater as well as a film festival film does.
Yeah, well, and that's why I think at least the versions of this thing we're talking about that I've seen, you wouldn't post your 10 pieces of filmmaking gear that changed my life. You know, you wouldn't show that at your community showing. You would show your this just randomly came to my head, but Eric Floberg made a film about his mom and his grandma and how they were artists and how that impacted him. That was a perfect example. Did you see that video?
That's such a good video.
Dude, it was phenomenal. Yeah, it was so good. I think it was called How I Became an Artist by Eric Floberg. That's my recommendation of the week. That was such a good video, but like, that's the type of video that, yeah, most of my videos I would have zero interest in showing in public, because they're kind of just this like buffer in between videos that I care about making. But if I made something like that, man, I would love to, a video about my mom or my dad and be able to premiere that in a theater. That would be sick.
Right. And what I am kind of interested in now, I suppose, and I don't know if this is one of those things where I'm going to look back in the future and be like, oh, that would have been cool, but it never came to fruition, or if I was like, oh wow, we were so right about that. It does actually seem to me, within the sphere, especially within the sphere of YouTube filmmaking, like filmmaking is becoming more important. It's like, the Eric Floberg thing is a great example. Like, there is a channel who has traditionally made similar videos that, you know, to like what you and I have made also, which is like, whether they be gear or editing tutorials or whatever. Now it's becoming like, it's sort of like, I'm trying to think of a good example, but essentially it's like, it's a little bit of a mark of credibility if you've actually made and uploaded a film now. So I'm seeing more people do upload things that feel more like films. Another really good example, that's just, I mean, it's hard to have this conversation and not bring her up, but it's like Natalie Lynn. Her whole channel is so much this like episodic film vibe, I guess. That is a really interesting example of what I think is a possible trajectory for all of this, which is like this compromise between the two things, something that can fit sort of in a film festival setting, but also feels very natural on YouTube. It feels like an evolution of essentially two parties coming together for whatever the goal of artists being able to distribute their work. It's like, it feels like this evolution that traditional Hollywood filmmaking people would be like, oh, that's not blah, blah, blah. And then YouTubers would be like, oh, that's not what we do. Instead, it's this new thing. Another great example is Joel Haver, who's traditionally made YouTube shorts, like under 3 minutes, basically, is now making 12 40-minute and over movies this year. And we'll see what the algorithm does with that. He's uploaded one so far, and it's not like slamming or anything. Last I checked, it had 33,000 views. But dude, to make a 40-minute movie by yourself that gets 33,000 views, no film festival.
Yeah.
No film festival in the country would do that.
Seriously. And it's so interesting that like even you just now threw up finger quotes for movies. And I think that's...
I shouldn't have done that.
Well, no, I mean, yeah, I think that's the coolest thing. I'm really new to diving into Joel Haver, but like, it seems like that's one of the things that he's best at doing is challenging what your definition of a movie is. And it almost feels like it requires the finger quotes to call what he's making a movie, but I don't know why you wouldn't. The only reason why you wouldn't call it a movie is because it doesn't fit the classic definition of having a full cast and crew.
Well, the hilarious thing is his first movie, he uploaded a video describing it like this today, so this isn't coming from me, but it's a found footage dramedy. So he was talking about how found footage movies are—they always have to have a bad guy or a horror, you know. But his is like a drama comedy with a character that's found footage.
Oh, that's sick!
Yeah, and he filmed it all on a dad cam, and it's funny because, like, you know, Blair Witch Project. Would you call that a movie? Of course, yeah, you would call that a movie.
Wow, what a man! Yeah, that's so cool.
It was such a, in my opinion, it was such a perfect tactic for the first movie.
Yeah.
To just be like, screw you. Yes, this is a movie. There are tons of found footage movies out there. Yeah, he is a genius. In my opinion, he has said, and I think I've even said on here that he has said, that we're on the foundation of the new film industry, and I completely agree with him. He's completely shifted my thinking about the whole thing. Because last year we would have conversations like this, and I would be like, you know, it's a institution film, you know, it's not like you can just say you're a filmmaker. You have to be whatever, christened by the institution. And now I'm just like, burn the institution
seriously
down.
Dude, that's so exciting. This is like a I don't know. I've been making YouTube videos for 7 years now, which is so weird. But the thing that's so funny is, even when I first started making YouTube videos in 2017, one of the most common things you kind of hear on the internet is like, oh my gosh, it's so hard to do now. It's so saturated. Like, everyone's doing it. And that feeling has basically persisted the entire time I've been making them. This idea of like, it's too late. It's saturated. Everyone's doing it. The trend is done. Figure something out. And like, oh, it's just so exciting to see how not true that continues to be and how fresh it all still is.
Yep.
And like, it just, even if it is saturated, which I still don't really believe it is, like, even if it is, like, there is always room for innovation and for it to become what we're talking about, for it to become this entire new way that movies are a part of our culture, essentially.
Yeah. Well, think about, and I've never actually thought about this till you just said that, but think about how photography used to be for photographers. It was like, you know, it's like,
Oh wow.
And then again, the word that keeps coming up is democratization, but it becomes democratized through starting with disposable film cameras and then going on to having a camera on your phone. Now everyone is a photographer. Making a movie is for Hollywood. It's for filmmakers. It's for cinematographers. It's becoming so easy to just have an idea, a story in your head, and just make it. Everyone can do it. Everyone has every tool they need to do it right now. And shorts feels like the preschool version of that. It's like all of a sudden everyone can make these short comedy skits.
Yeah.
Who is making short comedy skits like as a mass popular thing to do before TikTok and Instagram and all? Now it's like super popular.
Yeah.
I don't think it's outside the realm of possibility that as it grows, and just like it was like with TikTok and everything, it was like everyone was like, oh, I want to learn this because it's so fun and so cool. Now long form is this new thing where it's like, oh, that's only for people who are really it's just like growing at a rate where I don't feel like it's impossible to have friends and be like, have you seen Jake's movie? Oh, yeah, that's awesome. Have you seen our friend Alex's movie? Have you seen, you know, it's like something that people do is like make movies, you know?
Yeah. Wow. That's really exciting. That's sick.
I know. It's super cool.
Pretty like mind opening, honestly.
And you know who wouldn't want to see something like that would be this big giant film festival circuit, because it's already a flooded, impossible thing to get into their film festivals. And now if it's just like everyone's doing it anyway and everyone is having an opportunity to share a story and has the equal chance that people will engage with it and see it and it'll be meaningful to them, it's like, why would you care?
Yeah, seriously. And there's so many forms of art that are just so inherently valuable on their own, Like whether you make money doing it or not, they're just so inherently valuable. And I'm kind of just thinking as I'm talking right now, this is not a developed thought, but I don't know. It's kind of exciting to think of movies as one of those forms of arts. That's not like, okay, I got to get funding for 2 years of my life so I can make this thing. Like, what if it was just, man, I got a long weekend. Let's make a movie.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. Which is completely what Joel Haver yeah, is doing exactly, currently.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
he's done a thing, the past couple of years where, sorry about the song.
Oh no, yeah. I just had another thought.
Oh yeah. Well, he's been doing a thing the past couple of years where he challenges everyone to shoot a movie within the time period that the Oscars are playing.
Oh,
and so everyone goes out and shoots a movie while the Oscar, and then yeah, I think you have like a couple months to edit it, and then he watches all of them and then recommends his favorite movies made during the Oscars.
God, yeah. Wow. Every single thing I hear about that guy, I love him more and
yeah,
more.
Yeah, he's the best. Cool. He really is the
gosh,
best.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, my thought was usually the child version thoughts that you have, a lot of those you can trust a lot. And one of those child thoughts is like how many people listening right now made films when they were a kid? Probably
yeah.
a lot. Like,
yeah.
Like that's definitely something I did, because you didn't have any of those rules in your head at the time. Like, me and my brother would just make action movies that were so, so bad, but they had a full storyline.
Yeah.
And it's been so long since I've done that, just because I've had compounded and compounded ideas thrown onto me that are like, you can't do that, you can't do that, you can't do that.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
But when I was a kid, I did that all the time. We had terrible, thought out, written out, scripted movies.
Yeah. And there's honestly probably more fun to make than it would be for anyone to watch. But that to me is also a good enough reason to do it.
Yeah, totally.
Like, which was kind of what one of my videos this week was about, is just like, I realized I'm a little bit salty towards the sentiment of keep doing it, it'll pay off one day, because that places the benefits of doing something above doing something, like the benefits of creation above yeah. creation itself.
Yeah.
Like and it doesn't even really work that way for other things. It's not like, you know, oh, like we've been snowboarding a bunch this week. It's like, start snowboarding because it'll pay off someday.
Yeah, interesting.
It
yeah.
won't.
Yeah.
But it's so fun. Seriously. And so you do it anyway.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's fun. That's just funny you say that, because that for sure was my first thought of if those barriers were gone and you just made more movies for fun, you obviously would get inevitably so much better at it.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that shouldn't be the reason you're doing it.
Right.
But you would.
Yeah, you'd get a lot true. Better. It's true. Yeah. So it's like, so what? So let's say you get really, really good at it, and no one ever tunes into any of them except you and your friends or whatever. Then you get to the end of your life and you have this beautiful, like the world's greatest scrapbook, you know?
Yeah.
And that has to be worth something. When someone passes away and you still have a scrapbook from their life, that thing immediately in one day goes from something that sits on the shelf to something that if the house burned down, it'd be the first thing you grab.
Mm.
Like, I see these things that you and I are doing now as a really similar thing, having yeah. this log of our existence and time here. No matter what I get out of it by the end of all of this, I know I'm going to feel like it was worth it, even if that turns out to be nothing material at all.
Yeah. Man, and completely just derivative side thought, but I keep seeing all of these, I don't know, this idea that's gaining momentum of making sure you have physical copies of the things you love.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of talk about that with video games right now, because obviously video games, you're buying just a digital copy of and kind of trusting that
it'll
that company
there,
actually
yeah.
lets you always use it, where like the big companies like Ubisoft and whatnot are kind of trying to make that not be the case.
Mm-hmm.
But you see people saying that the same thing with photos. So many of us have photos that are only on Instagram and nowhere else.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, you really should print those out, yeah. you know? And,
yeah.
and I mean, A, how much more are you going to enjoy it if you have a curated collection of photos that you've printed out? But anyway, the moral of that circle of thought was, it would be so fun to take some of our favorite videos that we've made and put them on VHS tapes.
That would be just so keep
them.
Fun.
I don't know what other medium I'd put them on. Cause
I mean, you could put on like a
DVD, but I don't even, I have a VCR, but I don't even have anything that plays DVDs.
Yeah. There's gotta be, man, I'm wondering,
there's gotta be a more fun
yeah.
physical version than a DVD. You know, yeah. DVDs just kind of suck.
That's true. But yeah, I like that idea. That's one negative of film I've always kind of felt, is it feels like you're just creating these digital files. Yeah. That...
You know those music boxes where you crank the yeah. little handle on the side and yeah. it plucks little notes? Be sick if there's a movie version of that where you just crank a wheel and it... Oh, like those Viewmasters.
Oh, that'd be cool.
Yeah. A really rapid-paced yeah. Viewmaster where you crank a thing.
Yeah, I think that is a Nickelodeon. Speaking of that, there's a... Man, it's from a video I still don't want to say on the podcast because it's too sacred to me, but it's one you've seen.
I know
one of the, in my humble opinion, the greatest works of art ever created. One of the guys that was filming on it took a bunch of frames from the video and put them on this marble platform with a metal, I'm sure there's a word for it, but essentially it's like this little flip book thing, and then there's a tiny wheel on it and you can flip through it. And you can see just like whatever, like 6 seconds of the film
yeah.
playing on the, and it's just that thing in and of itself is such a work of art.
Dude.
Separate from the image that you get to see, but then with the image, it's like,
yeah,
I want one so bad, but they're all sold. They're sold.
Yeah,
out
not only are his images incredible, but he invented and designed that physical
yeah.
card flipping thing. Yeah, yeah, that's just, that's another level of ingenuity and creativity.
I know
so insane.
So anyway, interesting it to see the like what the future of film festivals and classical distribution holds as we live through what I consider to be kind of what music went through in the 70s and 80s and on till the present, which is just it got easier and easier and easier and more and more and more people were able to play along. And
yeah,
I don't, you know, who knows what the future looks like from here. And again, I gotta stop stealing all of Joel Haver. I mean, I guess I'm sharing
just hyping
his
him
thoughts.
Up. Yeah, totally.
But one of the other things he said is he's like, if you're one of those people that thinks the more people that get into it means there's more competition, then you're on the wrong side of history. And I totally agree with him on that. It's like, this should be for everyone.
Yeah.
It's too good of a thing to hoard.
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway.
But yeah, speaking of parrots. Sorry, do you have any more thoughts?
No, carry on.
On filmmaking? I can't believe I didn't think of this earlier. Speaking of parrots, you showed me the most beautiful, yet should have been the most terrible, but ended up being the most beautiful talking parrot movie trailers I've ever seen. I teared up in this movie trailer,
dude,
which has not happened in a long time. I tear up at movies every once in a while, but a trailer,
I know.
Hopefully that doesn't just mean my hopes are crushed when we see this movie.
I'm so scared because of course it's an A24 movie. It's an A24. You just have to see it. The movie's called Tuesday. You just gotta watch. It's Tuesday, right?
I think so.
You just gotta watch Tuesday. The trailer for Tuesday because it is so wild that it can go from, oh, this looks kind of interesting, looks very A24, to this looks wild and not good.
Yeah.
And then by the end of the trailer, you're like, this has potential to be my favorite movie.
Yeah, seriously. It just...
It's got the worst animated CGI parrot.
Uh-huh.
With the worst voice.
That talks like Christian Bale Batman.
Yes. Yeah. And somehow it just works.
Somehow I can tell it is going to directly target the most like Jake Fruit, what am I trying to say, basically just my most pinpointed favorite type of story.
Yeah.
It's going to just like bullseye target that.
Yeah.
Like the thing that just gets me more stoked than any other type of story, it's absolutely going to be spot on to that.
The thing that's so interesting after watching it and thinking about it for a couple days is if it was just that trailer without the weird CGI talking parrot, it would not have stood out much at all. True. It would have been like, oh, what a great scene that will be in this otherwise semi-forgettable movie.
Yeah.
And with this totally gimmicky parrot, I'm like, well, could be the best movie ever.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Yeah, that's funny. Are you going to see it, or are you going to just let the trailer be sacred and leave it at that?
I like to think I'm going to see it.
I like to think that too.
The
but
part
not
of me that knows
hopes.
Me is, I think like probably what will happen is you'll see it before me,
mm-hmm.
you'll love it and tell me it's amazing, and then I'll just take that to heart.
Yeah, you're like, oh, good. I'm
yeah,
glad.
Thank God.
Then
yeah.
you just keep and living your life.
And then I'll actually go breathe some fresh air and.
Yeah, I never do that.
No, never, not once. I want to like movies. I just kind of don't.
You spend an hour talking about movies and how excited it is that movies are for the people and everyone can make movies, and the conclusion
this is the most
I want
to
like
this
movies.
That is more core to what I'm saying than anything, because
yeah.
I like making it more than I like consuming it. And I think that's what I'm excited about, the democratization
okay.
thing, is more
yeah.
people get to feel what I feel about it, which is I like the feeling of being whatever, like artistically tuned into my own life to figure out what I can pull out of it for
uh-huh.
someone else.
Yeah.
We both have read, even though I think Seth Godin's kind of like not cool anymore or something, but we both read The Practice by Seth Godin.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole premise of that book is that like creativity is a generous thing. And I love that. I love that, that way of looking at it. And so, yeah, the thing that excites me about movies is that more people get this opportunity to be artistic and give generously to the zeitgeist of humanity.
Yeah.
But I'm not going to watch it.
Well, I also would argue that you just don't like the current main, basically the main stream of movies.
Maybe. I don't know. I feel like I'm having a really hard time finding movies
No, I'm saying per our whole discussion, if there's
yeah.
this whole new definition of movies.
Yeah.
Like, because clearly you love Joel Haver.
Yeah,
clearly
but the
you
funny
love,
thing
like,
is,
snowboard
I
films.
I haven't watched any of his full-length movies ever.
Mm.
And I actually don't even really watch his shorts either. I mostly watch him talking about the... He has a second channel, Joel Talks About Movies, and I watch that channel more than... And I actually think I don't like movies.
Wow.
But I like the idea of making them, so I don't know.
Man. Well, that's good news for our movie podcast.
Yeah, I know. I know.
No, I'm just kidding. Yeah. No, that makes sense. I think that's really beautiful when you can find that much value just in making the thing.
Yeah, I don't know, man. I don't know. I feel like I used to more than I did. Like the feeling of like sitting down in the comfort of being like, oh, for the next hour and a half, I get to like escape a little bit. I don't know what has changed in me, but I don't feel comforted. I feel trapped for an hour and a half.
Dang.
I feel like my mind is in a prison.
Dude. It's like a drug for me. It's literally just like full escape. Like I do not exist for an hour and a half or 2 hours. It's crazy. I love it so much.
That's interesting.
Yeah. But hey.
That's life. Just how it goes.
Did you see this new island that we discovered?
The infinity shaped
one? Yeah.
Yeah.
What is that?
I don't know. And I also have had this globe forever. We had this globe like when I was like, it was in my house when I was like 0 years old. And I'm pretty sure there's a bunch of countries and cities on here that don't exist or got renamed.
Hmm.
So
that's probably true.
That's nice.
You got anything else before we get to our apologies?
No, I think I am done now.
Mm.
But apologies sound good. I'm sorry for all the noise.
Mm.
And the construction sounds.
It's like silent now.
I know. I don't know. They just came out for when we were recording a podcast.
I'll bet no one heard any noise, honestly.
Yeah, maybe.
It felt pretty quiet.
Yeah.
I'm sorry to Japan for some reason.
It's not your fault they landed upside down on the moon.
Are you sure?
No.
Okay.
What?
There
was a Friends with Benedict's listener in the control room. He's like, oh, it's going so well. Space news.
He's like, man, those boys are running out of things to talk about. I gotta.
But
give
he was gonna
something.
Do a quick. He was gonna do a backflip and then still land it right side up. But he.
Oh,
messed up.
Yeah, that is probably what happened.
Mm.
Yeah,
that's gotta suck so bad, dude. Like all that time and money, and like there's so many smart people working on it, and you get all the way to the second,
dude.
You're like done.
Yeah,
and then it's like. And flips over upside down, and everyone's just like, no.
Dude, and imagine the tension of knowing it has the capability to flip back over. It just needs enough charge in the
battery.
Yeah,
I know. And then you got to build a battery robot to go and fly up and fix it, because it's probably like millions and millions of dollars worth of time and work and material.
Hey, maybe when the good old US of A is looping around the dark side, we can just like drop a grappling hook.
Yeah.
And just try to like catch it and flip it up on our way by.
Yeah, that's true. And probably it'll be like in the USA moon mission, it'll be further down the road and there'll be like five guys and one girl. And they're going to be like, we need someone to go down and flip it over for Japan. And then they do rock, paper, scissors and the girl wins. And then they go, all right, you're the first loser. And they do rock, paper, scissors again until they narrowed it down to a big, strong man.
And they say, we designed this parachute that'll get you down there so you can flip it over. And they say, what do I do after I parachute down and flip it over? Don't worry about that. It's fine. You just need this data.
The first woman to stay on the moon.
Oh, man. I should probably pitch that grappling hook idea to them.
Yeah.
NASA probably hasn't thought of that.
Dude, that would be so funny, too, though. Like, Japan's already having a bad day, and then they come down, and the grappling hook grabs it and just, like, throws it, like, 400 yards across
splits
the
it
moon.
In half,
yeah.
Shucks. That'd be amazing. Thanks, America.
Yeah.
Oh, well,
yep.
Sorry for being sleepy, and that's it.
Yeah,
that's
sorry
all.
Sorry to Sundance Film Festival that it is the way it is. One thing that, okay, last thing I want to say about Sundance before we end things off, which I also thought was interesting, was it's not entirely Sundance's fault. It is just the shifting interest of people.
Yeah,
so
totally.
Yeah, it's not like we're out here being like, oh, Sundance is dropping the ball.
No.
It's more just like things are evolving and changing. And
it's just like Blockbuster. It's just like, yeah, just a cultural shift. And
so this is not a hit piece against the Sundance Film Festival.
Definitely not.
It's more just like, I don't know, things are changing. What are you going to do?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. If anything, it's just an interesting conversation of like, okay, how will this or should this evolve? Because
and to say people are losing interest in something doesn't mean it's bad. It just means, everyone that works there sucks and are corporate sellouts. That's all I'm trying to say.
Yeah, exactly.
If I had names, I'd drop them. Amen.
I say, if you don't like this music, you don't be listening to it. You know, I'm just a dude that you know, or something similar. If you don't keep it real, can you go somewhere but here? Cause you know, we're only losing control just for a minute or